Hey, everybody. Welcome again to F This Movie, the official podcast of FThisMovie.net, movie love for movie lovers. My name is Patrick Bromley, and I'm super, super excited for this week's show because I get to welcome back to the show. You remember him from the Beyond episode in October, writer-director Jackson Stewart. How are you, sir?
I'm doing well. Thank you for having me on again.
Thank you for coming back on. I should warn you ahead of time, your friend and mine, Mr. Elric Kane, did refer to our most recent episode as adorable, so you better up the adorable factor or we are going to lose a major listener.
I will certainly do my darndest, as the kids say.
Jackson is the writer-director of Beyond the Gates, which, if you are listening to this show, you have heard me talk about a whole lot in the last year or so, because it was my favorite horror movie of last year. Tonight, we are going to talk about Dario Argento's 1985 movie Phenomena, a.k.a. Creepers, if you've only seen the shorter American version. But before we do that, I will start the show the way I almost always do and ask you, Jackson, have you seen anything good lately?
Yeah, you know, I just saw a movie on Sunday night at the New Beverly called The Seventh Juror, which is, it's basically a French sort of crime thriller, and it's about this guy who kills this woman in this sort of like weird drunken incident, and he ends up being on the jury for this guy who's been accused of killing her, and it's super weird and depressing and pretty interesting. But I went and watched that with my friend Nick McCarthy, who directed The Pact, and David Burke, the writer of the Paul Verhoeven movie L, which was pretty cool. And I could just get my requisite name dropping out of the way right there. I saw that. That was pretty great. And what else have I seen that I dug? Surprisingly, I thought the Power Rangers movie was pretty good.
I haven't seen it, so I don't know.
It's not bad. I mean, it's kind of like they take the fun elements of the show and then they sort of do like a deconstructed version of it, where like the whole, almost the entire movie is them training and figuring this out and like sort of like working out their group dynamics, which I was a big fan of. But yeah, Bryan Cranston is in it as Zordon, which is kind of cool. And I don't know, it was surprisingly like really well done. I was expecting it to be like another, you know, Bay Transformers or something, it's shockingly good. Yeah, those are kind of like the two main ones of recent memory. Impression.
Were you a Power Rangers fan, like, growing up?
You know, I was up to a point, I think, until they had, like, the White Ranger came in, and then I just, like, knew something was up with the show, and I couldn't quite pinpoint it, but later on I found out it's, like, three of the actors quit the show, and then they had to, like, do all this, like, weird, you know, creative editing and like voiceover and all this other bullshit to make it seem like they were still there, and then put these new people in their place to kind of like cycle them out. Yeah, I mean, I was for like the first season or so, I guess, okay. Which I guess was like 60 episodes.
Oh my gosh.
Yeah. It's kind of nuts. It's like that show became like an insane cash cow and, you know, made them billions of dollars. So they moved it from being a once a week show to 5 days a week. And it's kind of unheard of. I don't really think they've done that with anything else since then.
I missed that whole thing, although I do remember going to see the original, you know, Mighty Morphin Power Rangers movie, I think opening night, I think I went to see Judge.
Oh, wow.
I went to see Judge Dredd, and I got out early enough, and I was like, yeah, all right, I'll go see Power. And I just sat there like just someone's
dad. What a double feature.
not understanding anything. Like, what? I don't understand. What is this movie? And I don't think I've seen either one since.
I don't think either of them really need a revisiting, you know. apart from that, it's those are the two main ones. I thought Logan was amazing, and you know, there's some older stuff, but I don't want to talk too long about any of that.
Sure. I happened to the other night introduce my good friend Mike to a little movie called Beyond the Gates because I got my Blu-ray early, and I was like, you haven't seen this yet. I was so excited to show him, and he loved it. That was probably my fifth or sixth time seeing it now, and
holy shit,
each time I just find new stuff to fall in love with. This time it was tracking shot through the video store. The first time we're in Eddie Brandt's, I just loved it. So,
well, thank you. Yeah, I mean, I kind of hoped it would be like a rewatchable movie where people would get more out of it on repeat viewings. And it seems like so far the folks who've watched it multiple times have liked it more as it, you know, with each viewing rather than less, which is usually not my bag. You know, I'm a big fan of like the stuff I can like go and revisit over the years and kind of get things from. So, but yeah, thank you for banging the drum on that. We've, you know, super appreciated your support on it. And it's been really cool to see people dig it. You know,
You know, I think a big part of why it's rewatchable, and one of the reasons why and not to put you on the spot or whatever, but it's any movie where you want to spend time with the characters is easily rewatchable because it's like, oh, I get to hang out with these people for 90 more minutes. And that was my first takeaway, and that has been my takeaway every time. Again, not to just make you feel uncomfortable or whatever, but every time I've seen the movie, I have loved that opening shot, and I started listening to one of the commentaries, and you guys kind of talk about it a little bit, but I love that opening shot of the dad as he looks at the video store, and it's just kind of this oh shit moment, and you know that things are going to go bad. And watching it this time, I actually thought of Spider-Man 2, my favorite superhero movie ever made, and a big part of it is because of the last shot of Spider-Man 2. That was when I was like, Sam Raimi, you get this! Because we get the big swinging hero shot, and it's so great. And then he holds it for one more shot, and it's just Mary Jane, Kirsten Dunst, looking worried about, hey, what's going to happen to this guy I love? And then it fades to black. And I was like, I cannot believe a $200 million movie just included that shot. I was so excited.
I'm also a huge fan of that. And yeah, I mean, like, that certainly like harkens back to, you know, The Graduate and some of that stuff where it's like you have this serious high point in your life. And I mean, you know, I can't remember if I talked about this in any of the commentaries, but one of the things that's supposed to be is that the dad's basically like realizing that he's inherited, or, you know, that he has all this like responsibility and stuff and has to really keep this thing afloat. And, you know, it's like you're kind of realizing like, oh wait, now I have like all the problems that come with getting the, you know, the luxury prize or like the luxury car or one of those things. And so I appreciate that you caught that. You know, I've heard some really interesting theories on what people think that is, but it's much closer to what you interpreted. So
And that I will say that came through on my very first viewing at the Bruce Campbell Fest when I saw it. That was the moment where the movie had me. And then it goes into the cool opening credits and, you know, all that shit. I'm like, oh, this is so great. But that moment I was like, oh, okay, I'm 100% invested because of the choice to include that shot, you know?
Well, thank you. Yeah, that was it was a big one. I could talk about that for a while, but originally I don't think we even had that opening on in the first cut of the movie. It was just
Yeah, I think you had said that on the commentary that it opened with the car pulling up originally.
Yeah, and they were just, you know, like you were kind of piecing together who these guys were. And I thought it would be – that seemed like such a good idea in my head while I was writing it. And then seeing it cut together, you're like, oh, no, you can't – like you can't do this in a movie. You know, it's like there's – I think you need it to be – it's like suggestive of something. But, you know, if it gets to the point where you're – just in the dark and trying to piece things together, it's you know, then something needs to be addressed there. But yeah, thank you, man. I greatly appreciate the comparison.
Two more movies I'll just throw out real quick. One is The Void, which is the new movie from the Astron 6 guys. Did you happen to catch that on like the festival circuit?
You know, they went like kind of just after we were done.
Okay, yeah.
I really want to see that. I love the editor. I think that I just saw that a couple months ago at my friend Tanner's house, and I thought it was hilarious, and I really, really dug it. But I haven't seen — they did Father's Day, and did they do another movie on top of that?
There was like a — it's like a it's not a short. It's like 30 minutes or so. It's called Manborg.
Oh, yeah. I think I wasn't as crazy about that one, but
no,
I really liked the editor. And I've heard like some mixed things on it, but I thought that movie was rad. But yeah, I'm very curious about it. It's like anytime there's an H.P. Lovecraft sort of mythos movie, it's very intriguing to me.
It's a weird — like, I really liked the movie, and again, it's super ambitious for the budget, and there's tons of like cool practical effects, and I really, really liked the movie. But it is this weird thing where — we were talking about this just a little bit before we started recording, but as I kind of step back, there's almost like I can point to 50 different movies that this is sort of an amalgamation of. A lot of times, like, right on the surface, you know, like,
yeah,
there's a shot that's like right out of Prince of Darkness, and a shot that's right out of The Beyond, and a character who's right out of Hellraiser, and it's like it all adds up to something that I dig, and I appreciate kind of the spirit of the thing, because so many of their movies have been pretty funny, and this one is not. It's like basically — it's pretty intense and serious. But I was wondering, as I almost want to see it again, because I couldn't tell, like, am I enjoying this because it's a mixtape of all these other movies that I like, or does this work as its own thing, you know?
Yeah, I don't know. I mean, we've kind of reached this like weird point where I think our brains are so saturated with these sort of like cult movies and things we loved that it's like it's like becoming like a diminishing returns type of thing, where like I feel like people are going to really have to start kind of like reassessing what made those movies work, and like kind of looking at them in the time period, because most of them, it's like they were trying to evolve from, you know, the stuff that like Hitchcock or Polanski or these other guys were doing. And obviously they didn't have, you know, the budget levels that those guys did. But, you know, I mean, their heads were like very much in this space of almost trying to like outdo them, which I think is pretty interesting. And more recently, it seems like people are just trying to like recreate that stuff without bringing anything new to it. And I'm not sure if I'll feel that way about watching The Void, but I'm honestly kind of excited about seeing it. So, you know, I'm sure we'll talk off air once I get around to watching it.
Yeah.
But I mean, those guys are talented. You know,
for sure.
I just think I think a little work in the story on some of the — not their movies necessarily, but some of these other things I've seen could really go a long way with people's enjoyment of them.
Yeah.
I don't know.
Yeah, no, it's not — I don't think it's enough anymore to just remind you of something that you used to like, because that thing exists. Just go watch that. And again, I'm not talking about The Void here. But, you know, that thing I like still exists. So why can't I just go watch that thing? You know, and I'm certainly guilty of it because something like Turbo Kid comes around and I love the shit out of Turbo Kid, you know, but Turbo Kid is like, hey, remember all this cool shit? Here it is.
But it's also too, it's like, I really liked Turbo Kid and I feel like, you know, it's like you can see the DNA of those movies in it, but like they're not repeating, you know, something like Rad or, you know, like even like Mad Max, which is an obvious influence on it. It's like, I don't feel like they're just copying, you know, like set pieces from those movies.
Right.
It's like Turbo Kid has its own thing going on of like, you know, here's, it has sort of like a hero's journey thing going on with it, which I think is cool. But, you know, it's like Apple isn't really like a character lifted from another movie. And I think she's super charming. And I really like that that actress. I like the kid, you know, playing Turbo Kid.
Yeah.
And, you know, it's just it's odd because it is like very steeped in that. But I think on a story level, they approached it as its own thing, which I appreciate. You know, it's not like a thing where it's like you just see the beats of these other movies that are baked into it. It's more like, I think on an iconography level, it's certainly like reminiscent of a lot of that stuff, but it's not, I mean, to me, I didn't get the feeling I was watching one of those movies while I was I didn't get the feeling I was watching 1990 Bronx Warriors
right.
while I was sitting through Turbo Kid.
Right.
You know,
right.
I was like, oh, this is kind of its own thing. Like it certainly like owes something to those movies, but it wasn't just like copying them wholesale.
Right. I think I'm just now I'm constantly second guessing everything. am I enjoying this as a thing, or am I enjoying the buttons that this thing is pushing, you know? It's a weird, anyway.
There's one thing I really, really want to throw under the bus on this, and I'm terrified to do it because I'm sure I'm gonna run into these guys at some point. But
is it
they
Stranger
basically
Things?
What's it,
is it Stranger Things?
No, I mean, I actually liked that. I thought it was a little it was a little too heavy on some of the sort of like pop culture references, but I mean, I thought overall, I thought it was a really good story and, you know, the kids were terrific, but it was actually, I'll give you a hint. It was a WNUF like movie and they did it nowhere near as well as those guys did. You can probably piece it together, and if not, I'll tell you off air. I'm not going to say it on here because
okay.
I'm sure the second I do, I'm going to like walk down the street and run into
it. I have two in my head that it could be, so I'll ask you after the show. It's got to be one of those two.
I'm sure it is. But yeah, it's like one of those I think is very guilty of what we were just talking about.
So in my head, it's this one, and I won't say what it is either, but there's almost nothing to enjoy. It's exactly what you're saying. And, you know, I thought Stranger Things was okay to pretty good. It was just one of those that really gave me this weird tortured moment of the soul where I'm like, is this good or is this just reminding me of things that are good? The thing that I'm thinking of that you might be talking about doesn't work as a movie. It just works as a cop. Hey, look how accurate this thing is. But beyond that, so what? It doesn't give you a story or characters or dialogue or acting or anything to care about. It's just, hey, we approximated this aesthetic. Good job,
us.
Yeah.
Yeah, it sounds like you're on the right track with that. But everyone's going to, I think at the point we're at now, everyone's going to be like, what the fuck are these guys talking about? So.
But the fact that it could be more than one thing is a problem, right? Like the fact
exactly. that's the other issue. I do want to go on record and say I think the WNUF Halloween special is absolutely brilliant, and I just saw that for the first time a couple months ago.
Yeah,
and
me too.
I was really impressed with it. I give those guys a lot of points, but yeah, that's. That's it. You know, I think we're both on the same wavelength about that.
The only other movie that I'll talk about, and then we'll talk about Phenomena, is something I'm sure you've seen, and it just got a Blu-ray release, which gave me reason to revisit it, and that is They're Playing with Fire.
They're Playing with Fire.
Please
God.
Tell
wait,
me.
Wait, is there another title for this?
Originally, it was just Playing with Fire, but then they had to change it because that was, I think, the name of, like, a porn?
Well, I can see Andrew Prine is in it, so I'm intrigued off of that. But I've definitely never seen this movie. And, in fact, I've never heard of this movie.
You... will love this movie. I think I first heard about it from Killer POV, and then, you know, now those guys are Shockwaves, but they were talking and describing it as this movie that starts out as like a kind of a, you know, an 80s sex comedy, sort of a My Tutor, where, you know, Sybil Danning is, by the way, at it's peak Sybil Danning. seducing her student, who's played by Eric Brown, I believe, who was, you know, played this part, I think, in Private Lessons. That was him, right?
Well, Private Lessons, actually, I like that quite a bit.
That's a crazy movie, too. But this movie outdoes it in craziness. And so she's essentially seducing the student. So it's this, you know, the 80s movie where the guy is sleeping with his teacher. And by the end, it has become just a like a full on kind of slasher movie. It's wild.
Wow.
Yeah, no, you have to check it out. It's wild. It's really fun.
Yeah, that sounds great, dude. I have to check that out.
I think it would be right up your alley.
Nice. Very nice.
All right, so let's
go ahead. Playing with Fire, I'm all over it.
Yeah, yeah. All right, let's talk about Phenomena. So I had asked you to come on the show again, and you so nicely agreed, and I said, what movie would you like to talk about? And you threw out Phenomena. So what about Phenomena made you want to choose it as this week's movie?
You know, it's a weird one, because initially it was kind of like it was like a more minor sort of Argento movie in my head for a while, because it used to just be like Tenebrae, Suspiria, Deep Red, and and like Inferno and stuff. And I remember Phenomena, I was like, oh, it's cool, like it's got some good stuff going on. But for some reason, it was like over the years I kept thinking about it, and it was just one of these movies that stayed in my brain where I was just like, God, what was going on with that? I was like, that's such a weird movie where she's like psychically communing with these bugs, and, you know, Donald Pleasance is in a wheelchair and gets this like really random death around the midpoint of the movie, spoilers. And, you know, there was just something really interesting about it to me. And then, you know, as I got older, I realized what the thing was, is that it's actually, I'd played this game back in the 90s, like the late 90s. It was a Japanese game called Clock Tower. And it is basically a complete ripoff of Phenomena, where it's like, it's this girl named Jennifer who looks exactly like Jennifer Connelly, goes to an all girls school in the middle of like, basically like the Swiss Alps. And, there's this like cruel, you know, headmaster there who looks a lot like Dario Nicolatti, and her young sort of demented son who is going around killing all these people in the school. And I was just, it was like probably 2 or 3 years ago that I figured that out. And I was like, oh my God, I was like, they ripped off Phenomena when they made this game. And so it's like, it totally like unlocked this crazy like connection in my head, and I've been completely obsessed with it ever since then. But yeah, you know, it's one of these things. It's been like a very rewarding movie to revisit over the years, and that's kind of why I wanted to talk about it.
I saw this for the first time, I want to say, early in high school, and I at that point I don't even know that Argento was like on my radar. Maybe I'd heard his name thrown around and stuff, but I don't think I'd ever seen an Argento film. And I came to it because I was friends with someone who was going through a real heavy, like, Jennifer Connelly period and was kind of obsessed with Jennifer Connelly. So we kept tracking down her movies. And we found this one. We're like, Creepers? Wow, I don't even know what this is. When did she make this? And we put it on. And, you know, when you have no context and you're not – and you're just putting it in to watch a Jennifer Connelly movie, it was like, what the fuck is this movie? It was, I think, a little too crazy for my brain to process. And I maybe only saw it one more time over the years. It wasn't really until that Synapse Blu-ray came out last fall that I then – revisited the movie and was still kind of like, yeah, I, you know, it's probably in my like next in for Argento. I think the three that you mentioned, Tenebrae, Deep Red, and Suspiria, are constantly kind of jockeying for my favorite, you know. And then Phenomena, I was like, yeah, you know, it's probably around like five or six or something like that. And then in preparation for this show, I've actually watched the movie three times in 2 days because there's three different cuts on the Blu-ray. And I was like, well, yeah. I kind of want to see the differences. And now I'm like, oh, fuck, no, I love this movie. This movie, like, I literally finished watching Creepers and then was like, okay, I'm ready for the 110-minute cut of Phenomena. I turned it and watched the whole thing again. It casts a spell, you know? Like, it's just that kind of, and a lot of his movies do that. I think this one more so than some of the others. Like, I love Deep Red a lot. I don't know that I could watch it, you know, back to back the way I could this, because this one is so kind of dreamy and the score is so, the goblin stuff, I'm not talking about the metal stuff. The inclusion of like a lot of supernatural elements. I don't know. It just kind of cast a spell on me, and I was able to watch it twice in a row, and now I'm 100% in on this movie. I actually came into the show prepared to say, like, I think I prefer the Creepers cut because the long one is a little bit slower and, you know, clunky in a few places the way Argento movies sometimes are. But as soon as I put on Creepers, I actually found myself missing a lot of the beats. And I was like, actually, I kind of prefer that it has a little room to breathe. And I prefer, like, understanding why she's eating baby food with a toothbrush, you know, instead of just in Creepers. It literally is just like the greatest hits, you know, it's in such a rush to get through everything. And that can be fun because it's all the crazy shit, but I actually found myself missing those places where it's able to breathe, because I think that's part of the way that he casts the spell.
Oh, yeah, absolutely. It's interesting, too, you mentioned that baby food thing, because I watched the longer cut last night, and it's basically her parent, not her, I know her, like, mom ditched her, but it was, like, her roommate's parents left it because they visited with their baby and left all the baby food behind. Was that what it is?
That is the explanation.
It's really bizarre. And I think when you're watching the Creepers cut, it's I feel like it's a lot closer to like an 80s slasher movie than it is like an Argento movie, you know, which I really like both of them. The Argento one has all these like weird sort of like, the longer cut, I mean, has these just like odd tangents, you know, like with, I'm trying to keep them all straight in my head together right now, but when she gets hit by that car, I feel like that sequence is like way longer than it is. And like, I can't, does she get hit by the car in the Creepers version? I can't remember.
She does. Yeah. But again, it's all kind of, everything's like condensed. Everything's truncated. It's like when you watch a movie that's been edited for TV and they're like speeding it up a little bit and taking stuff out. It just kind of feels like that, or it's kind of rushing breathlessly from one thing to the next.
Because I remember in Creepers, it was just like that scene just like races by, you know, where it's like she gets hit and then I almost feel like it's I don't remember them like grabbing her as much, which like that I thought was like really awkward and weird. I was like, so because these guys are like trying to like rape her here, what is going on? And it's like you can't really figure it out. It's like, are they trying to like calm her down, or I don't know what's going on. It's a very weird scene, but you know, they throw her out the car and then they're just like, oh well, and then just speed off. And it definitely adds to that kind of dream logic, if you will.
Well, again, even that scene with the roommate with the baby food, not only is there kind of an explanation of the baby food and why it's there, but then you also understand why the roommate is so familiar with her dad, which gets skipped over. Yeah. The whole story about her mom leaving with her lover is taken out. And I mean, some of this, I recognize that some people don't like the dialogue sections as much, or kind of the more narrative driven moments. But I think some of that really informs the movie. Like I was beating my head against a wall. Like, why is this baby food thing here? This is so weird. Why have this beat where all she has to eat is baby food? And then the more I thought about it, the more I was like, oh, 'cause this whole movie is about like kids not being allowed to grow up, sort of, right? I mean, we see
yeah
that.
I mean, it's, you know, to me it's like there's this thing, there's like a theme of abandonment in there, you know. And it's like, you know, because even her getting thrown out of that car is kind of echoing that on like a thematic level of, you know, it's basically like her thing is she's afraid everyone's going to leave her in the way that her mom did, you know. And it's like her dad has essentially done that, even though he hasn't written her off, you know. He's just doing it in a more sort of like socially acceptable way of being, you know, away for work on a movie set. And, you know, that kind of feels like it's echoed throughout. And weirdly, like the counterpoint to that is the Daria Nicolotti character, Bruckner. I'm spacing her first name.
I think they just Frau call Bruckner. Her Frau. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. It's, you know, it's like her caring for her kid and is like almost like the sort of like her like nightmare, like wish for like maybe what she wants for herself, where it's like her mom is there to protect her at all times, you know? And it's, I think there's something really interesting in that. I don't know if some of that's accidental or that's just my own interpretation of it, but there's a lot to kind of like dig into on this movie and peel the layers back with.
Well, you know, the opening scene, which is like so great. I don't know. I was sitting there like, oh, is this my favorite Argento opening? Oh, because then what about Deeper? Ah, but what about Suspiria?
Yeah.
But I love this whole opening sequence. And that right away is kind of dealing with the idea of abandonment, right? When the girl is left behind.
Oh,
by
totally.
Her, by
yeah. Yeah. Exactly. I mean, there's a serious, like, that's such a strong theme in it. And it's basically, I mean, it's sort of like echoing what, you know, not echoing, but it's like acting as foreshadowing as what might happen to Jennifer in, you know, a pretty obvious way. But yeah, you know, it's also too, I wanted to like sidestep really quickly and talk about how weird that house is that they're in that she like finds her way into, where it's like somehow like right next to a waterfall. And it's also, there's like this weird underground tunnel that leads out to a dock. It's very strange. I've never quite understood like where, I mean, they're obviously shooting in multiple locations, but it's her getting her head smashed through the glass in front of that waterfall. You're just like, who would build this? Like, why? it's such a weird thing. It's like, you just feel like Argento probably like wanted to see, you know, this like raging waterfall behind this girl as she was murdered.
Right.
And he had to like figure out a way to do that with his, you know, like more familiar trope of getting like someone's, you know, head smashed through glass and, you know, getting their neck all cut on it, which is one of his go-tos. But yeah, I mean, I feel like you know, on a story level, there's some really interesting stuff going on in it. And, you know, the Donald Pleasance character is kind of like acting like her surrogate father almost, which is, there's like a really cool relationship between the two of them in it. But yeah.
Well, so not to compare Argento to Spielberg necessarily, because they don't have a ton in common, except that they're both, you know, great filmmakers. But I've always heard this thing about Spielberg where there's the T-Rex attack in Jurassic Park, that if you actually step back and like consider the geography, that it doesn't make sense. But it doesn't matter, because in the moment you're not thinking about that. You're caught up in the movie, right? And I mean, that's true, I think, just from the outset of Phenomena, because everything you're saying is 100% true. And yet, until you said it, I had never thought of it. Like, yeah, who built this house? And why is there a tunnel system? And why is there a window that backs up to a waterfall? Like, none of that makes any sense. And yet, I watched it 3 times in 2 days. And every time I was just like, yep, I'm going along with this. No, now she's at the window in front of the waterfall. And by the way, that's his daughter. This movie opens with his daughter being beheaded.
Yeah, exactly. Is it really?
That is his daughter. Yeah.
It's not Asia.
It's not Asia. It's Fiore Argento.
Oh, okay. I was like, yeah, there's no way, because she would have been, Asia would have been like way too young for that. But yeah, I mean, dude, Dario Argento definitely needs some therapy. I think safe to say.
He's getting his kids naked. He's beheading his daughter in the opening scene. Yeah, Daria Nicolodi is like, being attacked, killed by a monkey.
His wife in that movie gets just like brutalized by a monkey with like a bunch of razors a straight razor taken to her face. It's like it's pretty extreme, dude. It's wildly entertaining.
Oh my gosh, yes. What are we to make then of the idea, you know, if so much of the movie is kind of about abandonment and kids being left behind by their parents or whatever, that the only sort of loving parent-child relationship we see in the movie, if loving is an accurate word, is the one with Daria Nicolodi and her mutant son. Like, what is that saying then?
I have a feeling that, I mean, we're getting like real deep on this and getting like very very college-y about it, but
you hear that, faculty of horror? We're fucking coming for you.
Yeah, I think it's my interpretation of that is it's like maybe that's Argento sort of like projecting himself as like, you know, what his like worst fears are, that he's like some kind of like, you know, twisted monster or whatever. Because I suspect that mother son relationship probably stems from his own past. It's interesting, too, because this is actually, Argento said this is his favorite movie out of anything he's ever done. And I suspect a lot of that is probably because it's a more personal movie. Because the story she tells is, you know, how Dario Argento's mother abandoned him when he was a kid. And it's, you know, I'm sure if he let that in there, there's probably a lot more personal stuff going on. Maybe he wasn't, you know, fully cognizant of it, because I think a lot of the time when you're, you know, writing or making a movie or whatever, some of that stuff is under the surface and you're not fully aware of it. But, you know, it's interesting. I think it's like a cool kind of like window into his psyche, you know?
Well, and it's one of these things, too, where I think so much, I think the movie gets discredited a little bit. I was trying to just read a little bit, you know, what have people said about this movie? What's kind of the temperature on this movie? And so much of it gets lost in like, oh, it's so crazy. She talks to bugs and there's this monkey with the razor blade.
Yeah,
and people kind of overlook the idea that there are any themes in this movie, or that it is a personal film for Argento. And the fact that it's like so weird and flawed, I think, in certain ways that some of his other movies aren't, but that it's still his favorite almost makes me love it even more, that he kind of loves the child that's a little bit broken the most.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, it is interesting too that you mentioned it, because it's like this sort of like surface details about, you know, it's like, oh, she's psychically communicating with bugs, and you know, there's this like monkey that, you know, runs around with a straight razor and kills someone at the end of it, I think is I don't know. I mean, it's always like bothered me a little bit that people were like that sort of reductive with it, because it to me, it was just, even though I wasn't fully conscious of it, there was always something a little more going on with it. And, you know, a lot of his movies are that way, where, you know, if you start peeling back the layers and kind of thinking about it on a deeper level, you'll find some really interesting stuff within it. You know, metaphorically or otherwise.
I thought it so strange. Again, I hadn't seen it in a long time before rewatching it fairly recently, even before these viewings. And so there were elements that I didn't remember, like, because it had been so long, I didn't even remember kind of, you know, Dario Nicolodi's son at the end of the movie or whatever. So the movie opens and it's like framing the monkey for murder. And I was like, well, what am I to make of this? Right? Because it cuts from that waterfall death to the monkey returning, holding the razor blade, you know, and Donald Pleasant saying like, hey, that's not a toy. Don't play with that. And so it's this like almost, is that Murders in the Rue Morgue, the Sherlock Holmes one, where it's like, spoilers, I guess, it's a gorilla committing the murders.
Wow.
And I was like, oh, so is that what this movie is? And I, you know, I remember it being crazy, but I completely forgot the end, which was super rewarding then to revisit it after so many years and be like, oh, wait, no, it's the mutant son. Oh, wait, no, it's Dario Nicolodi. Oh, wait, a monkey is killing her. it was very rewarding, but I thought it was such an interesting misdirect in terms of setting up the monkey as the murderer, because, you know, we get those shots of the chains early on in that waterfall scene, and then it cuts to the monkey, and so it's like, oh, we, you know, our brains just fill in, oh, it's some sort of animal that's doing this.
I mean, it's, although, I mean, there's some misdirects, you know, with like, there, I mean, in the longer version, at least, like, I that was the one I watched last night, so that's the one that's just most fresh in my memory. But you know, when they're on the bus, and then there's the, you know, the person in the fedora and the trench coat, which, you know, we can probably assume is the Dario Nicolodi character after watching the movie. But, you know, they do kind of try to misdirect your suspicions a little bit in some interesting ways, like you were saying.
Is she, and this part I'm still not even sure I understand. So is she, are we meant to believe that she's committing all of the murders? Or is her son the one killing the girls and then she's killing other people to cover it up?
You know, I'm actually, it's interesting you mention this, because I always thought it was just Dario Nicolodi the whole way through. But I think there might be some, I think it might be one of these like double killer things along the lines of, you know, Tenebrae.
Yeah.
And I must have just missed that if that is the case. But it's, you know, I mean, it's certainly like that kid is trying to kill her at the end of it. So, you know, it's, but actually, I don't think it is the kid though, because it's like you see the silhouette of that, you know, that figure in, you know, in the fedora and the trench coat in Donald Pleasance's house. And it sure as hell is not that, you know, 2.5 foot kid there.
Yeah, those I kind of assume are Dario Nicolodi. But I was sitting there wondering if the girls that are killed, because you don't ever really see who's killing the girls. You just kind of see that weird little spear thing being assembled.
Yeah, you know, you might be right.
It's I don't know.
It actually, because, I mean, that spear or whatever does seem, I mean, he does seem pretty pumped on that at the end of the movie when he jumps into that boat and starts trying to stab her with it. But yeah, I don't know. I mean, it's definitely worth a revisit to go back and try to figure that out. Yeah, I don't know.
And I mean, I don't want to give away, I guess spoilers for Deep Red. Also, if you've never seen Deep Red, skip ahead a few minutes. But Deep Red also deals with some mother-son murder stuff. You know, the roles are kind of inversed, where the son essentially accepts the blame for the murders to protect his mother. Right. But yeah, we get that same dynamic in Suspiria. We have the same dynamic of young women more or less abandoned at a school. So in a lot of ways, it feels like Phenomena is a bunch of ideas that he's worked with, you know, over the course of a handful of movies, kind of all put together.
Absolutely. And I mean, and you know, the weird thing too I was going to mention about that is Phenomena, for a long time, I didn't, you know, like in my high school years, I knew there was a sequel to Suspiria, and it obviously wasn't called Suspiria 2. But for a really long time, I thought Phenomena was the sequel to Suspiria, because I was like, oh yeah, it's like the girls' school, and, you know, it's like this American who's in the, you know, in the middle of a foreign country, right, and all this other stuff. And, you know, it seemed, at least like story-wise, a little closer to Suspiria than Inferno did, even though Inferno, you know, they mentioned the three mothers and all that stuff. But, you know, it's like there's a lot of similarities. It's like her being drugged, you know, by the heads of the school, you know, to try to like keep everything under wraps and prevent their secret from being uncovered. You know, that's present in both movies. But yeah, I mean, I do think this, in a lot of ways, this is sort of like the, you know, his amalgam of all the other, right, movies that came before it, you know.
And I'm always a huge fan of those kinds of movies, that there are these movies that you can point to. Like for me, Femme Fatale is like every Brian De Palma movie kind of filtered through one movie. And I love that movie. And Phenomena is starting to feel a little bit, you know, especially even as we talk about it more, it's feeling more and more like, oh, this is kind of the culmination. It's not necessarily his best movie or his most polished, but like the one where he's channeling everything he's been doing. And so you even get, you know, elements of giallo movies in kind of these cool set pieces. But then you also have kind of the supernatural stuff from Suspiria and Inferno kind of bleeding over. And so it's like this marriage of these two kinds of movies that he's been making his whole career as well.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, that's a pretty spot on comparison. I hadn't really thought about how it's, you know, an accumulation of those things, but yeah, I think you're right on the money.
So, like I said, I was trying to dig around a little bit and I didn't find much, you know, analysis about the film. Most of what I found were just kind of capsule reviews or the occasional horror blog, just being like, this movie's crazy. There's a monkey, there's bugs. You got to see it. Which is fine. You know, it's entertaining. I don't ever want to take that away from the movie either. But I did come across this article from some site called Flick Feast, which looks like a British site. This was published in 2011, but I just want to read. I've never heard of this site. I don't know if it's still around, but I just want to read the opening paragraph to you and see kind of how you react to it, because you'll see. Okay.
All right.
Phenomena is a movie that manages to offer the best and worst of Dario Argento. I've never known a filmmaker who's always so close to creating masterpieces repeatedly only to sabotage himself in the smallest details. What to say of a filmmaker who knows the camera as if it were his own eyes, who uses color better than many classic painters, whose macabre imagination often captures the point when reality and dream converge, but who doesn't grasp the basic elements of storytelling, dialogue, and characterization. He's a frustrating filmmaker because he's terribly good and yet requires the viewer to make some allowances, to turn a blind eye a couple of times. There's suspension of disbelief, and then there's watching a Dario Argento movie.
yeah, I mean, it's It's interesting hearing some of that articulated in that way. I'd never really thought of he's someone who blows it in the small details of it. But I mean, there is, I guess there's some truth to that, because there was just these like bizarro sort of, I mean, like, you know, the monkey coming to the rescue and killing this woman with a straight razor is a great example of that. Or, you know, Dario Nicolotti chopping this guy's head off with what I think is the world's strongest piece of sheet metal.
Holy shit. That beheading is amazing.
It's like, what is that? It's just like sheet metal, though.
Yeah, right? That seems like what she's trying to then stab Jennifer Connelly with, too. Yeah.
Yeah, it's so, it is, I mean, it's that moment is absolutely amazing. But it's also, it's one of these things where you're just like, it's just like, it goes in such a weird, like, it's such a huge tone shift, because most of it's this kind of like sweet story about this. And then there's just this like really bizarro, like explosive moment of violence, which I love. But yeah, I don't know. It's just very odd to hear it all broken down like that. I can certainly see where they get it from. But, you know, I mean, I think these movies resonate with people for a reason, you know, and I do think a lot of it is because of the sort of, you know, the symbolism in it and the thematic stuff. And, you know, it's not just all the cool, like, monkeys killing people or, you know, Dario Nicolotti chopping people's heads off with sheet metal or that guy breaking his thumb or whatever.
Oh, yikes. Oh, yikes.
Which, like, by the way, the how they stage that with him, like, he immediately grabs her with his hand with the broken thumb.
Right.
And starts strangling her with that. And you're just like, you're like, you really couldn't have just had him, like, wrap the chain around her neck or something. Like, it's like he immediately has to just, like, put his limp hands like right up to her throat, which somehow immediately overpowers her. And it's a very weird moment. But yeah, I think the small details of that would certainly line up with that, what that reviewer said.
But reading it, it almost kind of goes back to what we were talking about at the beginning of the show, where it's like, I'm kind of calling into question, okay, why am I enjoying this thing? And am I, as this writer suggests, kind of giving a pass to certain things or making excuses for certain things? And in some instances, I'm sure that I am. And there are plenty of filmmakers who I'm an apologist for. And I'm like, yeah, that shit doesn't matter. You know, I'm a huge Tobe Hooper fan, and I recognize not every one of his movies is perfect, but I love him. But at the same time, watching this, I mean, there's all these weird moments of dialogue. That first scene in the cab or the limo or whatever it is with Dario Nicolotti and the bee. I mean, the way that Dario Nicolotti reacts to the bee, talks about the bee, just and then the dubbing like removes it one further step. And so then I'm like, oh, okay, am I excusing this, or is this part of what I'm responding to? You know, like, I don't know. I've seen enough movies that look and feel exactly like regular life. And so I'm just not a subscriber to this idea that, like, well, there's a right way to do it, and Argento doesn't do it the right way, therefore we're making excuses for him. You know, like, that B scene is insane. Or her saying, like, they call it Swiss Transylvania, which is a line they wrote into the script. And then Jennifer Connelly says, really? Why? And the line they came up with was, I don't know, they just call it that. Like, either take that line out or come up with a reason. You can write any reason why it's Swiss Transylvania. But at the same time, I'm like, is that part of the thing that keeps me coming back to these movies? Because they are just sort of left of what another movie would be.
Yeah, I mean, honestly, a lot of that is what attracts me to Italian movies, where they're like trying really hard to kind of make them American. They just have these bizarro sort of like logic swings on them, where, you know, you'll be totally with it, and then that guy has the bee. It's like the driver's reaction to that bee in the car is like one of the most It's like one of the most explosive reactions I've ever seen, where he's like, ah, you know, and he's like
the bee is on the roof and he's trying to shake it. Like,
yeah,
ah!
Exactly. I mean, he reacts, and like, if he found out like Jason Voorhees was in his back seat, like trying to like stab him with a machete or something. And it's just so strange. But yeah, the Swiss Transylvania line is a great example of that. There was another movie too, which I'm spacing the name of. And it's sort of a tangent, but they were trying really hard to convince you it was made in America. I think they brought this up on Pure Cinema.
Yeah,
maybe this past episode.
It was Pieces.
No. I don't think it was Pieces. It was another one where it was like this guy, his room, he just had a bunch of Coke cans hanging from the ceiling.
Shit,
and
I
was like, that's exactly, like, it's just the right kind of misinterpretation of what is going on, and it ends up being like super entertaining, where like you can tell they weren't trying to like make that, you know, absurd or whatever, but it just comes across in this way where it's like, it's just very charming. And I think, you know, as much as you know, there's a lot that's accomplished about this movie and others like it, you know, I think that stuff certainly plays a big part in it, where it's just like these big leaps, you know, that you don't see in like, you know, a George Romero movie or something.
Right.
And it keeps them very lively and interesting, because it makes them unpredictable in a way that, I think a lot of other American filmmakers would not be able to.
Yeah. Honestly, you know, I will fully admit to like not being able to, I was kind of resistant to it for a long time. I kept watching these Italian films and being like, I don't know. Like I think I was trying, I had more of a conventional idea of narrative, or I don't know. And I don't know if it was just a switch flipping in my brain, or if it got to a point where I saw enough movies where I was just like, ah, I'm ready for something different. But, and again, the movie that did it for me, weirdly enough, was New York Ripper. And I was like, wait, I'm all in on this. And that is a, you know, a repellent movie that I love, but like, it's a tough sit. But something about, maybe it was like the duck voice or whatever, something, I was like, I am hypnotized by this. And I started going back and rewatching all these movies and just really having such a new appreciation for them, in a way where like, now this is the stuff that I seek out way more so than, you know, some other maybe more traditional or just American stuff. And that's not me being like a European snob or whatever. I'm just saying, like, if it's a choice between, you know, some sort of Halloween knockoff from like 1984, which I'll totally get around to eventually, don't trust me, or some weird Italian movie from the same time, like, I'm going to gravitate towards the Italian movie because I don't know what I'm going to get.
Yeah, it's just, it's such an odd, it's so unique to the Italian culture, I think. And it's also, a lot of those movies were very informed by like what was going on, you know, in American, you know, with American directors at the time, because they had so many of those, you know, Italian ripoff movies, which I'm sure we could do a whole nother episode on that. But, you know, it's like, you see what the sort of like cultural filter would be for like, for a movie like Escape from New York, or, you know, with, you know, 2019 After the Fall of New York, or even, you know, 1990 Bronx Warriors is sort of like a weird Escape from New York type of movie. And, you know, there's a whole handful of these, but, you know, there's like, oh, what does the Italian version of Jaws look like? And it's, you know, Enzo Castellari's The Last Shark, where you're like, okay, this is kind of close, but it's also like way off. And there's like, this like really like hilarious, entertaining way. So, you know, I have a lot of respect for that, but I also feel like Argento is one of these guys though that does think about this stuff on a very deep level. And I mean, if I could compare him to one of his American contemporaries from the same time, I think he's like, he's kind of like the Italian Wes Craven, you know, where he's like very much, you know, thinking about it on a deeper level and in the story and like the symbolism and that type of thing. And then there will just be these sort of like bizarro pops of like anti-logic that are peppered throughout the movie. Like in, you know, I mean, Wes Craven, I absolutely love him, but, you know, he was certainly pretty guilty of that with, you know, a bunch of his movies. God, what was the one I was just thinking of? I mean, Last House on the Left, I think, is the most obvious one where you're like, oh, here are these like super disturbing, you know, brutal rape scenes, and then let's cut to this like zany cop footage, you know, like that's probably the most obvious one. But there's also, you know, there's something to be said about the unpredictable nature of these kinds of movies that I think is probably why guys like you and I respond to them equally as much as the, you know, deeper, more thematic ideas in it.
Yeah. The last major point that I kind of want to touch on is the monkey, because I don't think we can have a conversation about the movie without like, why the monkey? You know, at some point these guys sat down and were like, okay, and he's got a monkey and the monkey is his assistant and the monkey ends up, you know, taking revenge and killing Daria Nicolodi. And it's so interesting. Like, there was a night where I did a double feature of this and Deep Red, and it was fun to kind of get the opposite ends of the spectrum of Daria Nicolodi, because in that movie she's so just like charming and wonderful, and then this movie she's a crazy person. And that's another version where I actually prefer, that's another movie I should say, where I prefer the longer cut, because the shorter cut of Deep Red does kind of ditch so much of her character stuff.
You know, it's weird. I only saw the shorter cut kind of recently, but that one I did kind of like the shorter one a little bit more, just because I'd seen the other one with the weird Italian drop-ins, and I was always just kind of like thrown off by that. So getting to see it, you know, and I think in the American one, they have him like staring into the blood and like shaking his head at the end of it as his reflections, you know, coming back up on him. And, you know, the longer one, I think it's just a freeze frame of it, which is kind of a bummer. But
I like the opening of the shorter cut is way better, too, because it just opens, you know, with that flashback, and then it goes right to the people, you know, the psychics on stage or whatever. And the longer cut has that scene of him practicing piano and all. And I'm like, I'm not into this. Just go. I love the opening. The opening of the short version is so great. So I'm sitting there. Why the monkey? Why the monkey? And is it something about, and maybe I'm just reaching here, but, you know, we essentially have two good characters or two hero characters in the movie. We have Jennifer Connelly, who has this relationship to insects and is able to sort of communicate with them on a level that the rest of us can't. And so Donald Pleasance, who's the other kind of hero character, has that kind of, it's not a psychic relationship, but he does have that relationship with a non-human, which is the monkey. And so we have our two hero characters who both have this ability to communicate with something that is not human, you know, that is more or less animal. I mean, is that, am I overreaching there to say that, like, that's sort of why the monkey is in there? Because it's sort of a mirror.
I think that's dead on, you know, and that's part of why they bond. You know, it's like, I don't think that I really don't think is an accident. You know, it's like, there's a reason why, you know, he's got you know, a monkey helping him in his lab, and his, you know, the room is filled with, you know, these cases full of insects. You know, it's like, that's clearly like their, you know, bond in the movie. And then, you know, of course he ends up kind of acting as like a surrogate father toward her. But no, I mean, I really think that's a big part of the reason why he's there. And, you know, when he gets killed in it, it obviously like ups the stakes pretty significantly with what might happen to her. But I think that's a spot on assessment. I hadn't even really thought about that.
Well, now I'm trying to think through some of his other movies, because I know there's, you know, animals play a major part, and I'm trying to think if like connection to animals is often a signifier of being not superior, but elevated in some way. But I can't think of another. I mean, Inferno, it's like the exact opposite, actually, where the cats.
Oh, God, yeah.
Right, exactly. So it's not always a positive association with animals that kind of mark his work. So I wonder if there's. Maybe there's like an article to write there or something, you know.
Well, but... it's also too. It's like the guy who does kill those cats and it gets like pretty brutally murdered in Inferno.
Yeah.
So, you know, I mean, it's like that guy's not, you know, championed in any way.
No,
I think,
no.
You know, I think his message around that is. I mean, to me, Argento, you know, despite like. I mean, he did do some pretty weird stuff in Deep Red. Like, they have that, like, pin through the lizard, which, like, they really did, which I think is really fucked up. But not that anyone doesn't think that's not fucked up. But, you know.
Taking a stand.
Yeah, exactly. My bold stance on something everyone already agrees with. But, you know, I mean, so it's like there was sort of like a weird animal cruelty thing in that, but apart from that, it's like it does seem like he's very much on the animal's side, like,
yeah,
based on this movie, you know.
What is the whole animal cruelty thing like
with Italians?
Yes.
I don't know.
Because it keeps getting in the way of like me enjoying a movie. Like, when I watch Cannibal Holocaust, I have to watch the version with those scenes cut out, you know? And,
yeah, I actually, you know, it's interesting. I've only been able to like stomach watching Cannibal Holocaust probably like twice in my life. But, and I do think it's a good movie. It's just, it's a very upsetting movie.
Yeah, yeah,
and
for sure.
I've actually been curious to try to watch it with the animal cruelty free version, because it's just, I mean, there's like I pretty much like make excuses for anything in movies, you know, as long as it's like done and with some purpose or, you know, for some greater reason. But like, I think most things should not be off limits, but that's one where you're just like, I really can't justify them,
right,
like, you know, chopping this turtle's head off or whatever. But I do not know what was going on back in Italy back in that era, but it was with those directors. But yeah, it's pretty weird and very jarring, and puts it kind of an ugly connotation on some of those movies.
I saw Wild Beasts for the first time.
Oh man.
And it's like, it's super fun, but then at a certain point they're just setting rats on fire. I'm like, what the fuck? I just want to watch elephants trample people. Like, you don't have to actually kill animals.
Yeah, I watched that a couple of God, I watched that a few weeks ago with Nick McCarthy, because he was like, oh, have you ever seen this this movie? And I was like, God, I'd never even heard of it. And we started watching it, and it's just so upsetting, dude. It's like,
yeah,
there's some really cool stuff in it, but there's just, it's the logic jumps in that, like, I mean, it makes Argento look like the Coen brothers, you know, because it's like suddenly the kids are all like, we don't like you, we're going to murder you.
Oh,
and you're,
yeah,
like, where the fuck did this come from?
It
like,
is bananas. The entire movie is bananas.
Yeah, it is. It's very, very strange. But yeah, that's another one where it's like, I sure wish they hadn't like killed all those rats when they made it. And it also too, it opens on like that, like decapitated horse head, you know, like getting like chopped,
yeah,
in half,
yeah,
by
I
a
forgot
butcher.
About that.
Like, oh my God,
yeah,
dude.
Yeah.
It's like, I think it's like his director card comes up over that. It's like, great. It's like, what a moment to drop that.
It's like Michael Bay's credit in Bad Boys 2 is over a burning cross.
Oh wow.
Yeah.
Well,
like, talk about a guy announcing himself.
I know. It's always interesting to see where people pick that. I mean, sometimes I don't think people have any purpose for where they put it. It's just, you know, they just roll with it. But yeah, it's that can also be very telling about the director's work to see where that stuff gets dropped in, you know?
Yeah. Anyway, all right, so I won't take up any more of your time, but thank you very much for talking about this movie with me. I like it even more now than I did before we started talking.
Oh, yeah, absolutely. We could go on with this for quite a while, but yeah, it was a blast, man.
And can you tell everyone when Beyond the Gates will be out on Blu-ray from motherfucking Scream Factory?
It is going to be, I think actually if you pre-order it now, it gets sent to you like very soon, like within the next couple weeks, but it streets on May 2nd. We're also doing a signing at Dark Delicacies in Los Angeles on May 6th at 2 p.m. and Barbara Crampton and Chase Williamson and Graham Skipper and Bria Grant and Steve Scarlatta and a bunch of the other people from the cast and crew will be there. So, you know, if anyone's in town, please come to that. And the Blu-ray is loaded up with commentaries. There's four on them on it. And there's like a behind the scenes doc and a Q&A moderated by Stuart Gordon and some other fun stuff.
Very cool. I've watched that the retro commercial like a bunch of times because Alex Esso saying I'll do it never gets old to me. Like I could just watch it on a constant loop.
Yeah, I dude, she's amazing. I'm trying to get her in for the sequel and a pretty big role in that. But yeah, she's awesome. I think she's hilarious.
Yeah, so good. Anyway, thank you so much. And thank you, everyone, for listening. As always, you can find our website at fthismovie.net. We're on Twitter. We're on Facebook. You can email us at fthismoviepodcast@gmail.com. Jackson, where can people find you online?
I'm on Instagram and Twitter with the handle at BossJacko. That's BossJacko. There's also a fun Twitter for Beyond the Gates, which is at Beyond the Gates _ that I suggest people check out. And, that's it.
And your Instagram, correct me if I'm wrong, is a lot of Power Rangers fanfic, correct?
not quite. Although funny, one of our stunt coordinator on Beyond the Gates actually was a Power Ranger at one point.
For real?
Yeah, his name's Azeem Rizik. He was the Black Power Ranger on the Super Megaforce season, which was like 3 or 4 years ago. But
oh my gosh. Like in the suit or out of the suit or both?
Both.
Oh, wow.
He's like a Persian guy, but he was also in like, I think he was in Assassin's Creed and that like Billy Lynn's long halftime walk movie. So he's been getting more work recently, but he's a super talented guy. Whatever, like big Azeem Rizik tangent here. But yeah, most of my Instagram stuff is just like older movies and just video games and stuff I think is weird that I feel like people might enjoy. So. It's good for genre fans.
Nice. All right. Awesome. Thank you, everyone, for listening, and we will talk to you next week.
Thanks for listening to FS Movie.